the early source with Elena at the end of Daily Chakra is a mid-12th century manuscript of Mox or Vitry. So Vitry is a town in France. Okay, so we have this mid-12th century manuscript from France, it's northern France, right? And it has daily Elena in Chakra. And actually it says, if you can see it, it says you say it balakash, you say it quiet. Okay, so unfortunately, this source does not say why we're saying it. Okay, so this is a big issue. We're going to solve this problem. When we get to page 10, I'll give you some suggestions. But this is our starting point, that we have daily Elena in the 12th century France, and they're saying it silently. Now, this manuscript of Mox or Vitry is very interesting because if you remember, you know, the Birnbaum Moxers, remember they used to have the calendars in the back? So this Mox or Vitry manuscript, which is the earliest Mox or Vitry manuscript, actually has a whole bunch of calendars attached to it. You know, many pages are missing, many pages are ripped. But two scholars, you know, they decided to analyze all the calendrical material, and they concluded that all the calendar material suggests that the manuscript itself dates from 1123 to 1154. They can't be more precise, but they're narrowing it down to 1123 to 1154. Now, that doesn't mean anything to you, but in Elena research, that helps, actually, because something happened in 1171, which is in the materials, I don't know that we're really going to talk about, but something happened in 1171 in France, and people used to think that that 1171 event was what caused daily Elena in France, but now we see that this manuscript, they were saying daily Elena even before 1171, so we don't have to think about that 1171 event anymore. Okay. So now we're finished with France. Now we're going to go to Germany. Germany is, of course, next to France, which, you know, you'll see is significant. So in Germany, we have the source here on top of page 2, Sidur Hasidei Ashkenaz. And what it is, it's the prayer book of Rabbi Yehuda Hassan, and it was put together by his students. So, you know, he's a leading figure in Hasidei Ashkenaz. He died in 1217. And again, we're talking now about Germany. So if you read on the top, he actually gives a reason. So there's daily Elena in this Siddur, and most of what's written here probably is by Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid himself and not just by a student. So let's assume it's by Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid himself. So he actually gives the reason for daily Elena in his society. What does he say? He says, because it has Askarat Hashem and Yichud Hashem. Okay, you see that it's at the top. So Askarat Hashem is very unclear. I asked someone who's very, very knowledgeable in this period, you can guess who it is, and he told me he realized he wasn't sure as to what this meant, but he suggested to me that it meant that Elena had some gematria that alluded to God's name, or some kind of letter pattern that alluded to God's name. But okay, but so that's not so important. But the real point is the next one, Yichud Hashem. So what is Yichud Hashem? See, Elena has the phrase in old, it also has So Einod is like the idea of God's uniqueness or aloneness. So you see, so Elena has this idea. Now, the Hasidic Ashkenaz community, the idea of Yichud Hashem was very important to them. What do I mean by that? Like if you open up the Rosh Hashanah Matzah and the Yom Kippur Matzah, what we recite in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we recite something called Shir HaYichud, right? But we're only reciting it on the high holidays, but this is a prayer that was written in their society to be written, to be recited every day. And it was either written by Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid or his father or someone close to them. So in this society of Hasidei Ashkenaz in Germany, they would recite Shir HaYichud every day. So Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid is saying here, well, you know, Elena has these Yichud ideas. So therefore, we're gonna recite every day. Now, if you really wanted to understand Yichud Hashem means, you have to read through the Shir HaYichud. It's very long, and you know, you can look at all the ideas. But for our purposes, we can understand how this community of Hasidei Ashkenaz who focus on the idea of Yichud Hashem, we can understand that they might have taken Elena and brought it into the daily service. But the truth is, really, what really happened? You see, got to be a little suspicious here. You see, Germany is right next to France. So if we see this thing daily Elena in France, and then a few decades later, it's staying in Germany. What's really going on is that the Minhag from France spread to Germany. I mean, that's, you know, you can't prove it 100%, but that's, you know, 98% of what happened here. And then what Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid was doing, he's just trying to legitimize the custom in the eyes of his own community and strengthen it. So that's what's going on. And the way to prove this is, in France, we said they were saying it balachash, they were saying it quietly. And if you look at the Ropeach on page two, which is it's kind of towards the middle of the page, the Ropeach was a student of Rabbi Yehuda Hasid. He says they said Aleinu kol yachid v'yachid. And that probably means, that's another way of saying balachash. The reason I'm suggesting this is because elsewhere, the Ropeach, and not on the, it's not on the sheet, but elsewhere, when he talks about Shabbos Aleinu, he said they said it balachash. So that kol yachid v'yachid thing probably is another way of saying balachash. So, if in France they're saying it balachash, and then in Germany they're saying it balachash, it seems like it's really the French minhag would spread to Germany, not that in Germany they suddenly, invented this on their own. Okay, so we're finished with France and Germany. Now we're going to go to England. By the way, you'll be able to ask questions at the end, but, we're letting me go through this while you're all being mute. Okay, so now we'll talk about England. So on page three, this is another sitter which has daily Aleinu. And this one, the binding suggested is from England. Okay. And basically, this sitter is unique because it has two blank pages at the end, right? And a Sephardic businessman went to England and he wrote down, he was a money lender and he collected money from people in England and he wrote down on the two blank pages, he wrote down the payments that he got. Okay, he wrote them in Judeo-Arabic. So, it's Hebrew letters, but it's Arabic language. But the point is that the people that he got money from were all important people. Or some of them were important people. And, some scholars said, hey, let's go and analyze the records of medieval England, and we can figure out who these people are, and then we can date the sitter. So one of the payments he got was from someone named William Shemeley. If you look on line 7 in the Hebrew with the text there, his name was Guliam Shumla, right? And they figured out that this Guliam Shumla, he died in 1202. And, certainly the payment was not from the state, it was really from a live person. So this sitter, which has a daily Aleinu with Dan the Shacharist, we see that it's dated to prior to 1202. Okay, so that's just, an interesting digression. And in general, the Minhagim of England come from France, so the sitter apparently has the Nusach HaTfila of France. Okay. So now we've done, England, France, and Germany. Now we're going to go to a different region. Let's turn to page 4. Page 4, we're going, and now we're going to discuss like Egypt and Israel. Page 4, on the bottom, we got something from the Cairo Geniza. Now what that means, they found like, a sitter from the 11th, 12th century. Most of the things from the Geniza are from the 11th, 12th, 13th century. So they found some sitter in the Cairo Geniza, and it has a text of Tfilat Shacharit. And in general, the text of this sitter has like an Eretz Yisrael text. Okay, so we have an Eretz Yisrael text of Tfilat HaShachar. Okay, and it's from, 11th, 12th, 13th century. It doesn't matter the precise date. So what happens in this text? If you look towards the bottom, they summarize what's in the text. Like 4 lines from the bottom, they tell you that this is the Tfilat HaShachar and it has a Psukei Dezimra. And what do we find in the middle of Psukei Dezimra? We find Aleinu. Okay, so this is very interesting. In this Minhag of Eretz Yisrael from, 11th, 12th century, they were reciting Aleinu in the middle of Psukei Dezimra. So this, of course, made no sense to me. And then I was walking with my friend Rabbi Moshe Yazir many years ago, and I told this to him, and he paused for 6 seconds, and he said, what's the word after Aleinu? The Shabbat. So it fits perfectly because Baruch Sh'amar is Tishbachot, Shabbat is Tishbachot. So Aleinu L'Shabbeach is a perfect fit for Psukei Dezimra. Okay. Despite all our, modern wrong intuitions today. Okay. And now I have something else very interesting on this page at the top. There's a work called Pirkei D'Rabbi Eliezer, which is from Israel, let's say from the 8th century. And there's certain passages there that one of them some of them we show them quote a certain passage from Pirkei D'Rabbi Eliezer, that this passage is not in our text of Pirkei D'Rabbi Eliezer, but let's assume that it was there originally. So if you look on the top, on the top of page 4, top left, so there's a passage, the statement in Pirkei D'Rabbi Eliezer that Aleinu was so important, b'chach tzarich la'omro me'umad. You have to say it standing. So now, question is, what Elena are they talking about? Because we're now, in, let's say we're in 8th century Israel. They weren't saying daily Elena at the end of Shacharis, right? So what Elena could they be referring to? So they're not talking about the Amida, because the Amida of Rosh Hashanah, because you're standing for the Amida, right? And they're not talking about Chazar HaShatz, because it's talking about something you have to say standing. So I want to suggest, I mean, this is just a suggestion, but that maybe this Suke de Zimmerman house is what's reflected here. In other words, we have this statement about Elenu in the 8th century in Pirkei de Eleazar, which makes no sense. So maybe we can link it up with, with the custom that we found in later period that they were saying Elenu in Suke de Zimmerman. But that's just a suggestion. You don't have to accept it. But then you still got to explain this weird statement in Pirkei de Eleazar. Okay. Now, let us go to page 5. So page 5, I'm going to explain to you the role of Elenu on Rosh Hashanah. And this is from the Art School of Master. So yeah, you should recognize this. So, on the top, we have the second, on the top, it's quoting from Alkane Nekava. So let's read, we're going to explain to you how Alkane Nekava leads into the 10 Malchiyot verses. Okay, the Kablu Kulam et Ol Machutecha, the Timlach Alam Meral Yolam Ba'et, Ki Hamachut Shalchati Ol Me'ad Timloch Bechavod. So we have four Melech words, and then they proceed to do the 10 verses. So this is like a perfect leading to Malchus, four Malchus words, and then you have the 10 Malchus verses. So, to me, this shows that Alkane Nekava was written as an intro to the Malchus verses. I mean, you can't really do better than this, okay? Now, what's interesting, if you paying attention carefully, so you see that Rosh Hashanah, we have basically, the Rosh Hashanah has 10 Malchus verses, but what do we do in the daily davening? We add verse 1 and verse 9. In other words, on the first page in Moksha Victory in France, when they adopted Elenu into the daily service, they didn't have any verses, okay? So they didn't have any verses. They only went up to Timloch Bechavod. And on page 2, the Rokeach in Germany, same thing. They only went up to Timloch Bechavod. But over time, so today, we say that first verse and we say the ninth verse. So how did this happen? So regarding the first verse, that one seems to have been added pretty quickly. I think it was added based on a gematria. I don't really want to discuss it further, but I think that's what happened. But the ninth verse, I'm always wondering why do we have verses 1 and 9? Why is there such a discontinuity? So the answer is they get added to different stages. So, all right, so the first verse was added, pretty shortly. I think it's already in the one with the English payment notations, where it has this Hashem Yom Ba'ed, right? But the verse in Zechariah, the Na'amar, that I think was not added until the time of the Ari, several hundred years later. We have to double check that. There's a new book coming out, I'm going to talk about in a minute, by Professor Reuben Kittelman, so we have to check what he said there, but I think that's what he said there, that our famous the Na'amar verse was not added till the time of the Ari. Okay. Now, we're going to go to page 6. Now we're going to talk about who wrote Elenu, which hopefully you've been wondering about for a long time. Okay. So you can trust me that if you go to page 2, you have Rabbi Yehuda Chassid saying right at the beginning that Yehoshua wrote Elenu. Okay. So, and this, he was widely quoted by everybody who came after. Now, before I finish my thoughts here, I want to just mention one other thing. In the Art School Siddur, it says that Haigon says Yehoshua wrote Elenu, and Haigon is before Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, but that Haigon reference, that's a mistake. Like there's a tshuva of Haigon, but the idea that Yehoshua wrote Elenu, that's like a later addition to the tshuva, was not in the original tshuva, so you just forget that, cross out the line in the art school, whatever, put the asterisk, whatever. Okay, all right. But we're talking now about Rabbi Yehuda Chassid. So he definitely said Yehoshua wrote Elenu, and everybody copied him afterwards. They quote him. But you see, he doesn't say we had a Masorah that Yehoshua wrote away. All he meant was, in my opinion, Yehoshua wrote away. That's all he didn't say, in my opinion, but that's what he meant. He didn't have a Masorah. Okay. But The truth is, anybody who looks at the vocabulary of Elenu will realize that it has the vocabulary of the Tanaitic and Amoraic period. So, for example, let's read something that I wrote here, the last paragraph in English on this page, on page 6. There's much evidence that Elenu could not have been composed by Yoshua. For example, Elenu cites verses from the prophet Yeshaya. 2. The phrase HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not an appellation for God in biblical times. 3. Terms are found in Elenu that are characteristic of Hechalot literature. And what does that mean? We're going to talk about that in a few minutes, but Hechalot literature is generally from the Tanaitic and Amoraic period. And what terms am I referring to? The terms like Moshe Yekaro, Shpinat Uzo, Gavhe Meromim, these are like mystical terms with, you know, combined two ideas combined in one. So this is the Hebrew of the, you know, the Tanaitic and Amoraic period. It's not the Hebrew of the time of Yahushua. And finally, it's not until the book of Daniel and perhaps Kohelet that Olam means world. Usually in Tanakh, from the 90% of Tanakh, Olam has a time meaning. So, you know, Elenu has the Takein Olam, the Olam means world. So you see, that's not the language of the time of Yahushua. It's much later Hebrew. Okay. So once we, you know, we're going to reject the Yahushua idea, but now I'm going to tell you a reasonable solution is that Elenu dates from the time was written by Rav. You know, Rav who argued with Shmuel all the time. You know, Rav lived in the 3rd century CE. Now, Rav has an interesting biography because he started off in Israel, then he ended up in Babylonia. You know, after I finish my argument that Elenu was written by Rav, you know, then you're going to wonder, well, did Rav know any Christians, right? So that would be an interesting follow-up question. So I'm going to say right now, I don't know the answer to that question, but I will say that there is someone who writes a column in the Jewish Link right next to mine, and he loves to write about the biographies of the Tanaim and the Maran. So we have to get him interested in this question, and then he can analyze the biography of Rav, figure out exactly where Rav lived in Israel, and then exactly where he lived in Babylonia, and then, you know, we figure out whether there were Christians in those days. Okay, but now let me explain the case for Rav writing Elenu. So you're supposed to understand by now that Elenu is the introduction to the Malchus, the introduction to the 10 Malchus verses. I'm going to call it the introduction to the Malchus. So the Gemara, whether it's the Bavli or the Yerushalmi, do not mention the introduction to Malchus. However, the Talmud Yerushalmi in two places mentions the introduction to Zichronos. Okay, so now let's look on the bottom, we're on the bottom of page 6. And let's look at the passage on the left, which is from the Talmud Yerushalmi, Rosh Hashanah. Third line. As it is written in the Tkiyatza of Rav, and now they can quote from Zichronos. They quote like 36 words, which match what we have today. So I think they quote, I think this amounts, I didn't really count, but it's like 15 to 20% of what we have today. And this matches what we have today. Now, you see, we have to understand, what is the word Tkiyatza mean, right? They didn't say the Zichronos of Rav. They said something broader. They said all three introductions of Rav. And Tkiyatza means the Rosh Hashanah of Rav, okay? So what they're saying is Rav wrote the three intros. That's like 99%, that's what that phrase means. That the Tkiyatza of Rav, Tkiyatza means all three intros together, okay? Now, but they're only quoting from the intro to Zichronos. So you have to get the conclusion that Rav wrote Elenu, you just have to make two assumptions, which I think are reasonable. The first one is, well, we see that they had Zichronos about 15% of what we have today, but I think it's reasonable to conclude that the rest of the Zichronos map what we have today. Again, we can't be sure, but you know, I think that's a reasonable assumption. Then once you make that assumption, then, well, if their Zichronos was the same, then probably their Malchus was the same too. So that's basically the argument. And, you know, I think that the Zichronos, Malchus, and Shofros kind of complement one another, meaning, like, there's a plan to it. Like, it's not like this mix and match. You know, in other words, if their Zichronos was entirely the same, then that means that it was the same Malchus that we have today too. So that's basically the argument. You just got to make these two reasonable assumptions that they probably had the same Zichronos as us, and if they had the same Zichronos as us, then they had the same intro to Malchus as well. You know, when I say Zichronos, I mean intro to Zichronos. Okay, so this is basically the argument. Okay, now, oh, by the way, let me just mention then the passage on the right, it has a slightly different girsa. In a different passage of Shalom, it says, Piyasa Debe Rav, the Rosh Hashanah Piyut of the Beis Medrash of Rav. But really, when if you look at that sugya, they're also saying, they're also assuming that Rav wrote this Piyasa. So the difference in the girsas is not significant. Now, there's that. The passage on the right is assuming that Rav wrote the Piyasa, so you know it's not just talking about the general Beis Medrash of Rav. Okay, now I'm going to mention the new book by Professor Reuven Kahneman. He's been working on this book on the daily liturgy, you know, for many, many, many years. So you know he's a professor of liturgy at Brandeis, and he's an Orthodox rabbi as well. So his book should be out in a few months. It's called The Rhetoric of the Jewish Liturgy. And it has a chapter on Matovu, Adon Olam, Ashrei, Psukim Zimra, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he also has a chapter on Aleinu. So I don't think this is top secret. I'm going to say what he says in his book. Okay. So he's going to disagree with me because he's going to say Aleinu was a little later than Rav. And this is his argument. He finds an Aramaic piyut from the 4th century, right? An Aramaic piyut from the 4th century by a Samaritan poet, okay? And it begins, Havlan Mishabcha, let us give Shevach, Lamara to Alma, let us give Shevach to the master of the world. So this is very similar to Aleinu Shevach Ladon HaKol. It's slightly different, but you know, mostly the same. And then he wants to say that, well, maybe our Aleinu is after this Aramaic one. But, you know, again, this is just conjecture. No one really knows. But it is interesting that there is such an Aramaic piyut by Samaritan. That's interesting, too. That begins, Havlan Mishabcha, Lamara Da'alma. But, you know, to conjecture which one came first, you know, that's just conjecture. Okay. We'll talk more about the Kimmelman book. You know, you definitely have to get the Kimmelman book. It's a Lippmann Library book. You know, tons of footnotes on all the daily davening and answer all your questions on all prayer. Okay. Now we're going to go to page 7. Okay. And now, you know, I told you I was going to eventually discuss whether Aleinu was written for Rosh Hashanah or perhaps written for a different context and then taken into Rosh Hashanah. So, and I showed you before on page 5 that to me it's clear that Al Kein Nekaveh was written as an introduction to Rosh Hashanah because it had all those Melech words, had 4 Melech words, and then came the 10 Malchus verses. I mean, that's pretty good. But I'm going to, here in this page, I'm going to mention the view of somebody else who takes the opposite view. Okay, I'm giving his name a shot. Okay, so we have to do now, just have to talk about Heichalot literature for a minute. Heichalot literature is a mystical literature from the Tannaitic and Amoraic period, and it often features Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael. And it's a pseudepigraphic literature, which means these are not real stories about Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael. Okay, so we're on page 6. Now look in the middle where it says longer recension. So what do we have in this longer recension? We have Aleinu in the singular. So let's read a little bit. In the longer recension, you know, Alayla Shabeach, Shalosam Chelki, V'Goreli, V'Ani. So, but what is this prayer in the context? In the context, you know, again, this is a mystical literature. So this is a prayer of gratitude recited by Rabbi Akiva on return from a journey to heaven. Okay, prayer of gratitude recited by Rabbi Akiva on a return from a journey to heaven. Now, Professor Meir Bar-Ilan, who's very brilliant in general, and he's a descendant of the Nitziv, he thinks Aleinu was taken from here or from somewhere else in this Heichalot literature and then barred into the Rosh Hashanah liturgy. So why does he say this? He has two general arguments. He says that in general, texts go from this special literature into regular liturgy and not vice versa. And secondly, he says that in general, texts that are singular are earlier than the ones that are plural. So he thinks, you know, Aleinu was taken from this literature and went into the regular literature, and then it was just went from singular to the plural. Then he also, I just wonder, this is very clever. So let's look in the bottom of page 7, the last three lines, just to listen to his argument. So the last three lines of page 7, he says, Lu Mechaber Elenu Shebech, if the author of Elenu, if he was writing his tefillah from Malchus, right, then what would he have said? He would have said, Elenu Lishabeach Lemelech HaOlam Letekidula Lemoshel Bakol. So, you know, he's making interesting suggestions here. Okay. But the point is that he realizes that the Alai L'Shabbat prayer does not make sense in that context, you know, the prayer returning from heaven. So he realizes that. So that's why he suggests, well, maybe it really comes from a different part of Heichalot literature. But we don't have any other evidence for it in Heichalot literature. So, you know, I gave him a shot, but he doesn't win this argument in my mind, you know. So that's all. But at least I gave him a shot. Okay. Now let's go to page 8. Okay. So now, well, this is all very important. Okay. All right. Okay. A major issue in Elena research is Elena and Alkane the Kavra were both paragraphs written at the same time. So I think the answer is yes. Because if you look at the bottom of the sheet, you see that both cite the same chapter from Isaiah, chapter 45. So let's look at the bottom, on the bottom of page 8. You see verse 20 has the phrase Mitpalim El El Lo Yoshia, right? That's within the first paragraph of Elenu. And that's 100%, that was the original, in the original text of Elenu. So it has, that's from the first paragraph of Elenu, Mitpalim El El Lo Yoshia. And on the end of 23, and that was adapted into the second paragraph of Elenu. So in other words, we have two paragraphs of Elenu, and they're both citing from the same chapter of Yeshayah. So sure, it's possible that a later author of the second paragraph started to cite from the first, from the same chapter that the author of the first paragraph was, but that's the lesser likely alternative. You know, Elenu is not a long prayer. So, you know, a prayer can have more than one theme, right? In the present, we do this, and in the future, we do that. That's not such a complex idea that, you know, someone can author a prayer, one person can author a prayer with two ideas. In the present, we do this, in the future, we do that. Okay? Now, I will say that, you know, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in his Siddur commentary, he says, well, they had different authors, but together, they go very well. So, you know, together they go very well. You know, that really suggests that really maybe they really were written at the same time. Don't worry, I'm going to agree with Rabbi Sacks soon. So just don't worry, I'm going to agree with him very soon. Okay. So now let's go to the top of page 8. I'm going to agree with him on a different matter. So that's not what I'm saying. Okay. The top of page 8, this is exceptionally important. The Rote Meherah Pitiberet Uzeha. So the question is, what does Tiberet Uzeha mean? So what it really means, it's a poetic way of saying Beis HaMikdash. That's what Tiferet Uzeha means. You know, I wish if this was live, I'd ask everybody to raise their hands. I'm curious if people really knew this before, you know. So but anyway, so you could send into the chat if you knew this before. I want to see how many of you knew this before. Okay. So you know, and right before it, there's the word Mehera. See, so is this suggestion 100%? To me, this is 110% because of that Mehera word, okay? The wrote Mehera, the Tiferet Uzeha. Now, this is not my idea. This is the Abudraham says it, and he's not the first to say it. People said it before him. But, you know, the way life works, you know, in America, like if something doesn't make it into the art scroll, then it's little known. So, okay, so I cited many verses to support the idea that Tiferet Uzeha is an allusion to the Beis HaMikdash. You should add, it's not on the sheet, you should add Echa 2:1, has the word Tiferet, and look at the dot mikra there. Again, Echa chapter 2, verse 1, look at the dot mikra. I'm gonna read one of the things inside here. Oz v'tiferet v'mikdasho, that's from Tehillim 96. Oz v'tiferet v'mikdasho. You know, on a Shabbos, we sing a song, Tzur Mishloch, Zvul Beit Tifartenu. So again, it's all over the place. You know, O's and Tiferet, this needs to be. So Midrash, you know, and the author of Elanim, he wanted to phrase his request in a more, you know, high level. That's all. So that's why he, in a poetic way. But, you know, everybody misunderstood it for years. Okay, centuries. All right. Now, okay, now I'm going to go to, you know, my favorite topic, right, which is Tikkun Olam, the Tikkun Olam. Okay, so many years ago, I wrote an article in Chakira where I explained that the real Girsa in Aleinu is the Tikkun Olam with a kaf, and it means to establish the world under the sovereignty of God. Okay, that's the real Girsa. Okay, and I just, I'll just tell you very briefly what happened here. So, you know, many years ago, my friend Yechiel Levy came to shul with his Teimani Machzor, and I saw that he had a kaf reading. And then I knew that Rav Saadia had the kaf reading. And I realized, oh, you know, this is really interesting. He changed the whole meaning. And then basically, I looked at the Rambam, but in the standard Rambam, unfortunately, the Rambam did not say Aleinu daily, but he did say in Rosh Hashanah. So if you look in the standard Rambam in Mishnah Torah, there is a Nuscha Tfila, you know, of Rosh Hashanah, but it had Bechule, too many Bechule, so no one knew what the Rambam's Girsa was. So, but basically then, you know, now they do all these good Rambams, and, you know, you can see that the people who do the good Rambams, you know, they all write that Rambam had it with a kaf. And then I did research on the Kairos Geniza, you know, from my home, with the site Geniza.org. You can look at all the Geniza fragments. So basically what I want to say is, you know, when I wrote my article in Chakira, I only had a few Geniza fragments to support me. But then in my later work, in Sfarim blog and the one in my Esther Unmasked book, so then I had many more Geniza fragments. So in the Kairos Geniza, you know, I looked at the Geniza fragments, you know, 19 of them had it with a kuf, one had it with a kuf, and one there was like a horizontal bar, and I couldn't tell whether it was a kuf or a kuf. But basically, okay, so, you know, I did all this research. I don't have time to really go into it, but the point is that there's enough evidence to show that the kuf was the original reading. And anybody who you explain this to, they all agree that contextually, the kuf reading makes more sense. Elanu has nothing to do with social justice or improving things. It's talking about establishing a world under the sovereignty of God. And by the way, it's also important to point out that even if the reading was with a kuf, kuf had the meaning of establishing too. One of its meanings. If you look at Jester on page 1692, you know, he mentions establish as one of the meanings of tikkun with a kuf. But even aside from that, I mean, I think the original reading really was with a kuf. And what happened is there's this phrase, tikkun ha'olam with a kuf, which is 13 times in the Mishnah, 70 times in the Bavli, et cetera, et cetera. So because of the common phrase, tikkun ha'olam with a kuf, some of that kuf in Elanu eventually got, you know, evolved into a kuf. All right. Now, we're doing well here. Okay. Now we're up to page 10. Now, this is all very important. And I hear, you know, people are supposed to admit their errors before Rosh Hashanah. So I'm time for me to admit my error here. Okay. So when I wrote about the Takane, you know, in Hakira and Farm Blog and in my Esther on Math book, I assumed, like most of us, that it was the Jewish people who were supposed to do the Takane. But only a few years ago, I realized that it's really God who's supposed to do the Takane. Here, I'm quoting Rabbi Sachs and Dr. Gerald Blitzstein, and they thought about this a long time, and they both agree that it's God who's doing the Takane. Okay? And, you know, my friend Rabbi Benji Yablok, he pointed out to me, we say, Alkein Mikaveh Lecha, we're waiting for you, God. Okay, so you see now, you know, if Rav wrote Elanu in the third century, so basically, it's taken us like 1800 years. Now we know how to spell L'Takein Olam, and now we finally understand who's the one who's doing it. Okay, now let's go to the bottom of page 10. Now we're going to answer the questions that I raised at the beginning of this year. So we mentioned that Elanu in France, they said they were saying it, the Lahash, and we're trying to figure out why Elena entered the Daily Shacharit. So, first, okay, there is a theory by Professor Tashma. I'm not going to go through it, but it is, I summarize it on the bottom of page 10 here. But he doesn't have enough evidence for his theory. So I'm going to take the other approach, which is what I'm going to read what I wrote here. In my view, and in the view of many others, Elena was likely introduced into the Daily Shacharit as a prayer meant to express a rejection of Christianity. Probably its introduction came as a response to the Crusades of 1096, or due to the general feeling of downtroddenness that the Jews of France felt while living as second-class citizens in a Christian land. And, you know, and that's why it's Balakas. They're not going to shout out, you know, these ideas. So, okay, but that's what's going on here. And again, there's no question. Shehem Yishtachavim will have a varik, mitalim el eloshia. There's no question that was in the original verse. Now, you have to forgive me. I want to go to page 13. So just let's look at page 13 because this kind of supports what I just said on page 10. Okay, so now this is really interesting. Okay, this is Elena with added anti-Christian language. Okay, and the earliest source that we have this is from that sitter with the payment notations, which is dated from before 1202. Okay, now let's look at it in Hebrew. I underlined it all kinds of weird words here. You know, first we say Mitpalim Le'Eloshia, and then they say Adam Afar, Dam Mara Batar Srucha Rima Tameim Tamal. Nothing, nothing, all kinds of craziness, right? So let's go to the English summary. This is by Ruth Langer. The intent of this insertion seems to be that other nations prostrate themselves to a man of ashes, blood, bile, flesh, rot, worms. This is a direct reference to Yeshu, emphasizes his base humanity, denying his resurrection, inserts in graphic terms that his body decomposed. Anyway, okay, so we have this, you know, severely anti-Christian passage, and again, its earliest source is the one with the payment notation from before 1202. So I wish we had an earlier source for this, right? Because I said that Elena was in France in like 1120 to 1140s, or what I 1120, 1150s, right? But the truth is, you see, maybe, you know, those on page one, those scholars, you know, they just guesstimate, they gave an estimate of 30 years. Maybe instead of using the 1120 date, maybe that Mosavici was from like 1150, and maybe the Cedar with the payment notations from England was from 1180. So therefore, then our gap, you know, wouldn't be so great. In other words, between like 1150 and 1180, something like that. So, but that's our situation. I mean, to really prove that Elena was seen as an anti-Christian prayer, before 1150, you know, you got to find some source from before 1150, but we don't have that. We have this source, you know, which is, again, sometime before 1202, but we don't know how much before 1202. But then there are other sources with this language, but they're all later. Okay, yeah, there are other ones, but they're all later. So this is the earliest one that I know. Okay, now. All right, we're nearing the end here, just a little more. Okay, so here, very briefly, on page 11, we're talking about Sephardic sources for Elena with the daily prayer. Just very briefly, the tour lived, started off his life in Germany, then he moved to Spain. So he says the Ashkenazim say it, and when he got to Spain, then he noticed the Sephardim say Elena, daily Elena too. Okay, so he lives in like central Spain, but then the Abu Draham, who lives in a different part of Spain, he's writing in 1340, he does not mention Elena. Okay, so you see, so we have the Tour writing in Spain, he does mention it, but the Abu Draham writing a different part in the same time does not mention it. And go to the Shulchan Aruch, you see on the bottom, the Shulchan Aruch, Yosef Karo does not mention daily Elena, but the Ramah answers. So, you know, basically I'm saying here that like the Tour is the earliest source in the Sephardic world who said daily Elena. You know, we have to check Professor Kimmelman's book. It is possible that I missed something, but you know, great. I missed very little. Okay. All right. Now we are up to page 12. Okay. Page 12. Now, most of what I say here is not on the sheets, so you just so I'll talk slow and just try to write it down. Okay. The topic now is Aleinu with daily Marah and daily Mincha. So, Aleinu in daily Marah, our earliest source is the Kolbot section 11, which cites Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, who lived in Germany and died in 1293. Okay, so if you believe the Kolbo, actually he abbreviates, I think it's not, we're not sure, it's Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, he writes Reish Mem, but usually they understand it's Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg. So Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, who in Germany, died in 1293, he already has Aleinu and daily Marah. And there's a slightly earlier source from Provence that's called Minhag Marseille that also has it in Marah. Okay, now the idea for Aleinu and daily Marah developed because Aleinu was seen as a parallel to Shema. You know, because of a node. So once Aleinu was seen as a parallel to Shema, then it would make sense to say to recite it in Marah. But in Mincha, there's no Shema, right? So, but it's very interesting. We do have a source in Mincha of Shabbos. There is one source that they were saying it as early as the 13th century. What's so special about Mincha of Shabbos? Because the Amida says Ata Echad. So in early 13th century Provence, they decided to say Aleinu at the end of Mincha and Shabbos because the Amida said Ata Echad, right? That means at the end of Echad. But as far as regular Mincha goes, you know, some people were saying it, but others were not. You know, it wasn't necessarily catching on. But then someone asked the Ravaz, this is in the 1500s, 1500s in Egypt. And this is on the sheet, it's on the top of page 12. So someone asked the Ravaz this question. He said, look, you know, some people are saying it, Aleinu at Mincha, and other people are not saying it. What should I do? So the Ravaz gave a very interesting answer. He said, precisely because there's no Shema at Mincha, then we have to say Aleinu at Mincha, right? He just turned the tables on the whole question. You know, we need to register this Yehud theme, you know, in this tefillah. So if there's no Shema, then we should definitely say Aleinu. Okay. So basically, you know, I'm kind of nearing the end here. So Aleinu, for hundreds of years, it was seen as a Yehud prayer, right, parallel to Shema. But now it ends up in our time being seen as a conclusory prayer, conclusion prayer, right? So on that note, I'm going to conclude my presentation, but I just want to mention a few more things. One thing I did not discuss is how Aleinu moved from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, so that you have to look at Professor Kimmel's book. Two, on that last, on page 12, very interesting, on the bottom of page 12, there's a source called Seder Hayom, and I quote it because it talks about people saying Aleinu seven times a day and backwards as well. So that's very interesting to read on. Okay. Finally, regarding my new book, I admit it does not discuss Aleinu, you know, but it has 62 interesting articles, such as on L'David Hashem Ori, Shalom Aleichem, on Miros, well, Sur, Halach Ma'anya, and I have biographies of Rashbam, Judah Turo, Golden Meir, and then 27 articles on interesting Hebrew words. So, you know, if you want to buy something, you could buy if you want to buy a book which has my long Aleinu article, you should buy the Esther and Math book, Esther and Math from 2015. But otherwise, you can buy the new one, which is great as well. And of course, they're both by the same publisher, so you know he'll be happy either way. Okay, I am done. Shalom, I am done.
Okay, well, this was excellent. And I would like to see some questions in the chat. If you could just send them in the chat, this way I could collate them and address them to Mitch. We had one question from before. Based on what you said about Shehem Meshach Vim Lehevel, Arik, do you believe that was the only later insertion? It's hard to understand what it says here. Was that
oh, that's not a later insertion. Insertion. That was there. That's in the original Aleinu. Shehem Meshach Vim Lehevel, Arik. That's 100% was there originally.
Uh-huh.
You know, you just have to look at the Siddur of Arsadeh. That, you know, for the look at our Siddur of Arsadeh, he's died in 942. You know, that gives you a basic text of Aleinu.
Okay. please, if you have other questions, just send them in the chat, because it's just, it's very hard to control a crowd with so many people. So if you could just put them in the chat, that'd be great. Somebody wants to know if you could repeat why we started to say Aleinu on Shabbos Mincha.
Oh, because if you look at the Mincha Shmoneh Esrei, what is it? It's to open up the Siddur, the Mincha of Shabbos Shmoneh Esrei, Atacha, or Shmoacha, you know, and there's, so it's all these Ahad thing. So that matches the Aleinu, the Einot idea. It's only Mincha that has that focus, only the Gemara of Shabbos Mincha that has the focus on the Ahad thing.
Okay, and do we know if Rav originally wrote it with anti-Christian messages?
Yeah, well, that's what I was trying to say. In other words, now if you agree that, you know, Rav is the person is the correct answer, then the next step is to figure out what knowledge of Christianity Rav had. He lived in Israel and in Babel, and you got to figure out exactly, you know, where in Israel he lived and where in Babel he lived. And he was a student of Rav Yerunasi, so that, you know, then you got to analyze where Rabbi Yerunasi lived and where the Christians lived in that time in Israel. I mean, I remember reading that they did have Christians in Babylonia in the third century, but exactly, you know, where they were and how many, you know, that's over my head.
Okay. And what's the name of the professor who wrote the book about the liturgy?
Right. So, yeah, he's been working on for many years. Reuven Kimmelman, Kimmelman. It's going to be a Littman Library book, The Rhetoric, Rhetoric, The Rhetoric of the Jewish Liturgy. You know, he wrote so many liturgy articles, and now all his ideas will be in one place. You don't have to, you know, dig them out and read them separately, and, you know, you put them into a book form.
I'm sorry, who wrote Rhetoric of the Jewish Liturgy?
Professor Reuven Kimmelman, Kimmelman.
Okay, thank you.
He's a Orthodox rabbi and professor of liturgy at Brandeis.
Uh-huh. Also, somebody asked, what you wrote a book about 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago.
My master's under Dr. Sid Lyman. My master's paper was on the Persian period, was on Seder Olam Rabbah. It has a weird chronology of the Persian period, a very short chronology, you know, very, very different than the secular history. You know, very, very briefly, three Persian kings in Seder Olam Rabbah, whereas there were really 10 kings in 200 years in secular history. And so I wrote all about that. So, you know, that was my master's paper, then became published as a book under the title Jewish History in Conflict. Was published by Jason Aronson, but they, you know, they're out of business, but they're, you can buy it anyway because they sold all the rights to Roman and Littlefield, so it's available, but it's expensive.
Can you explain how the Shema is a parallel to Aleinu?
Well, you know, Shema, Shem Elokeinu, or Hashem Echad. So Aleinu had these ancient old ideas and Ephesula, so, you know, it's like a rough parallel to Aleinu. And, you know, for hundreds of years, you know, like in 11, 12, 1300s, this was reflected in the liturgy. Okay, I mean, I don't remember the examples, but everybody understood this parallel.
Sorry to wrote great talk. I mean, everybody's saying that basically, a great talk. If one recites Aleinu more often than required, does that constitute a violation of some kind? Or do the extra recitations bring additional merit to the person performing the extra recitations?
Okay, that's too hard for me. But I did on that last page of my handout, I did cite a mystical source in the 1500s where they sang it seven times and even backwards. So,
okay, I believe Rav Yehuda Hanasi lived in Beit She'an, but mostly in Sipori. Rav was a ben bayit to Rabbi, and his uncle Rav Chia, and must have been exposed to Galilean early Christians. That's what Ira was. Rebbe was a ben bayit to Rebbe and his uncle Rav Chia.
Okay. Very good. I, you know, this is, you know, early Christianity. That's not my field. So, and I didn't. I
You
never
don't fit
imagined there
into
were.
early Christianity.
I never imagined there were Christians in Babylonia in the 3rd century, but I saw something like Ruth Langer mentioned that there is such a concept. So,
Okay. Somebody was kind enough to post the Jewish liturgy book. So I think what I'll do is I'll just send that in an email because I'm having trouble with my mouse. But thank you, Ari. Any other questions or comments?
again, it's nice to see everybody, and I probably only have an idea of about a third of you because I only see about a third of the names here, but I wish I could say hello to all of you, but okay.
Okay. Well, wait, we have another question. I feel like we're on a game show. On Rosh Hashanah, we don't have the anti-Christian message. How is that? Hi, sorry, I said that. Is that true? We don't have the anti-Christian message on Rosh Hashanah?
There's a text of Aleinu, right? So see the quite see if Rav wrote Aleinu, we don't have to assume that he was writing it as an anti-Christian text. In other words, I'm just saying that in the 1100s in France, then they started thinking of it in this anti-Christian way. But I didn't say that Rav wrote it with an anti-Christian message. Right, that he's allowed to, he's, you know, he's quoting verses from Yeshaya, but Yoshia, right? I mean, that's a verse from Yeshaya. So I'm not claiming Rav had an anti-Christian message. I mean, this is something that could be researched, but you know, I don't know enough about Rav to make that claim. So we're just reciting what Rav wrote. But all I was saying is that in, you know, the daily liturgy in France here in the 1100s, then it started becoming understood as this anti-Christian prayer.
Okay. What about the bowing of Anachnu Karim? Any idea where that started?
Right, let's think. I don't want to. It's been a long time since I researched that, so I'm going to pass on that one.
Okay. That's fair. Can you clarify why you think Aralenu preceded similar Hechalot texts?
Why are Alenu?
Preceded. Similar Hechalot texts.
I'm not sure what does that mean? Well, in other words, okay. All right. You see, I think that the Alai L'Shabeach in the story of Rabbi Akiva returning from heaven, it doesn't fit the context. So that's they're stealing it from regular Alenu. It's not vice versa. So that's what I think.
This was really very elucidating, and we definitely would need another whole session to cover all the questions that people have and to do more justice to this topic. But this was really great, and I'm really happy about the turnout. This is the first of our series, so nice turnout. And Mitch, I really appreciate your scholarship and you're willing to teach us a lot about Elena, especially since Rosh Hashanah is coming up. So thank you so much for that, and thank you everybody for coming, and everybody have a chasima chasima tova, and see
John,
you.
thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. And the truth is, I really learned a tremendous amount from preparing. You know, even though I knew like 90% of the stuff before, I learned a whole bunch of new things, which were very helpful to me.
Wow, that's a lot. That's pretty amazing because you've done this topic numerous times, at least in writing, you know, if not in orally. So that you learn it each time is incredible. And everybody's saying Yasher Koach and thank you. And so you're welcome. Thank
Okay. Thank you.
you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Shlomo. Thank you, everyone.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thanks. Have a good night. And Shana Tova.
Shana Tova. Bye-bye.